In a world in which movies struggle to find plot, Alan Adams of The Main Edge breaks it down for you in Pass the Popcorn. Now on Downtown with Rich Kimball.
Let's all go to the lobby.
Oh, yeah, time to talk movies. Alan Adams from The Main Edge joining us right here in the studio. Hello, Al.
Hello, sir. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about yourself?
Oh, can't complain.
How was your weekend?
Good. Very busy. Well, it was my father-in-law's 80th birthday.
No way.
So happy birthday, Gordon.
He's 80?
Yeah.
The man looks like 50.
Yeah, no, he carries it well.
Wow.
But we had initially planned to go out of town, to go down to Boston and do a big celebratory thing down there. Circumstances changed, as they do. Both of my in-laws are very cautious with regard to the COVID situation, and with the new developments, they decided maybe it would be best if we stayed a little closer to home, and so we had a couple of big nights out here in Bangor. We went to to dinner at Timber on Friday night, which was wonderful, and then we dined at the Tarantine on Saturday.
Oh.
You're
not the one who stole the Nutcracker and then brought it back, are you?
It was funny. We actually we delighted in sharing that story with Sheridan's brother and sister and their respective spouses who made the trip up as well. So it was really nice.
That's awesome.
It was lovely. And then yesterday was a bit of a roller coaster. I attended the memorial service for Marsha Douglas, which was held at the University of Maine. On yesterday afternoon, and then from there, we went and saw Dominic Varney's one person show, Living in Drag, at the Bangor Arts Exchange.
I heard that was phenomenal.
Just great. You know, and it's just like it's a massive undertaking to put something like that together, to develop like an original work like that. And I
didn't realize that he and our friend Phil Burns and his son Harry wrote original songs for this too.
Wow. Yeah, there's I want to say 6 or 7 original songs.
Wow.
And a wonderful performance, and frankly a surprisingly rowdy crowd for a Sunday night, but but you know that's what you want. As I said, busy weekend.
Well, that's fantastic. And glad to have you here with us to talk about a trio of films. Where should we begin? Should I get out my saxophone?
we can start there. I watched a movie called Listening to Kenny G. It's part of HBO Films' Music Box documentary series. There have been a number of interesting entries into that already. They did a Woodstock '99 documentary, the film Jagged about Alanis Morissette. That's through them. I think they did a DMX one as well. But this is the first one I had watched because, I mean, I frankly was just fascinated by the idea of a documentary about Kenny G. I mean,
yes.
What is it like what must it be like to be someone who is both wildly successful and utterly reviled?
Right.
Because that's the thing. Like, yeah. It's just like, I mean, he is, and they make mention of this several times over the course of the documentary. He is the best-selling instrumental artist of all time.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's particularly close. Like, he sold something like 75 million records.
Oh, my word.
Which is an astonishing number when you think about the guy as, you know, the dorky dude with the big curly hair playing his soprano sax or whatever. But it's really interesting. The director of the film is the documentarian Penny Lane, who is wonderful. She's incredibly talented, and she's known for taking on just really strange, sort of fringy type subjects. I think she's best known for Hail Satan, which was a documentary about the Church of Satanism. So she tackles this in this really interesting way. First of all, ton of sit down stuff with the man himself. Like, she spends a lot of time with Kenny G. And that is sort of juxtaposed with a series of talking head interviews with basically like exactly the people who hate Kenny G. jazz writers, jazz critics, that sort of thing. And you sort of you know, you move back and forth between, you know, conversations with Kenny G about, you know, his upbringing and, you know, how he came to, you know, to be what he has become. And then you have these other guys, you know, and they look like the sorts of guys that you expect them to look like, just going on and on about what a travesty he is and, you know, how what he, like, he's, you know, it's not really jazz and he's ruined jazz. And it's like, pick a lane, guys. Like, is it not really jazz or did he ruin jazz? Like, you can't have it both ways. But really the fascinating stuff is when you kind of get to know a little bit more about Kenny G, because I like, he's a cipher to me. Like, I have no right. concept of who he is.
All I know is that he seems to understand how people feel about him and doesn't take that part of his career that serious.
Right. And that's the big thing when you watch this is this is a dude, like, the first words we hear him say in this entire documentary is the director, Penny Lane, asks him, how you feeling tonight? She's off camera. And he kind of smiles and he says, oh, underappreciated, but, you know, other than that, fine. You know, and it's just like, okay, so you get it. Like, you, you know, and there are throwaway lines here and there where you're just like, okay, this dude definitely understands stuff. Like, he's like, look, you know, if I cut my hair tomorrow, my career's over. You know, stuff like that. And you're just like, okay. But then, like, you watch him. First of all, I had no concept of what his process was like. And it is utterly unlike anything that I have seen. He doesn't live record. I mean, he records. But, like, it's not like one take and that's the song. Like, he goes back in with, you know, computer editing and will fix, like, a run or a note. Or part of a note.
Wow.
And, like, sort of put it all together to create, you know, he considers himself to be a perfectionist. And, you know, and there's some ego there, which, I mean, I don't know how you would escape it,
right,
being as successful as he is. But as these, you know, these other guys are sort of tearing down what he does, you know, you're hearing about people who, like, get married to Kenny G songs. And, you know, it's the first dance at their wedding. There's a brief subsection about how many people consider Kenny G to be what they call baby making music, which leads to one of my favorite parts. They've got one of the critics, I forget which one, sitting there, and they're talking about this whole idea of Kenny G as baby making music, and he's like, oh, I don't, you know, this is, you know, I don't believe that doesn't make sense to me, and then he sits there and they play one of the songs for him and he just sits there in silence for a few seconds. And then he's like, I don't know, maybe, you know, and it's just like, it's like he's changing his mind about it in real time. And what was the other thing that I learned that I just want to make sure I get the song right. Because there was something that I'd never heard this before. So he has this song called Going Home. You may not have known this, Kenny G, incredibly popular in China.
I did not know
that. Massively popular in China, to the point where this song, Going Home, has become almost the national anthem of the end of the Chinese workday. Like,
wow.
So, like, at the end of business, like, loudspeakers in malls and retail stores and public plazas, like, they all play Going Home. And that's when people go home.
Wow.
And it's just like you just, you know, you see him as this dorky white dude playing a saxophone, and it's easy to forget just how wide, just how long a shadow he casts. And again, you know, like, your mileage may vary. Like, it's not like I'm sitting here as some sort of Kenny G super fan. I don't actively dislike the music either. And I mean, I guess that's kind of the point.
Right.
Like, it's perfectly suited to be the background music of our lives. And really, what's wrong with that? I guess that's where we get to with this movie. It's a lot of fun. It's really interesting. He's an odd dude, but he's odd in the ways that you would more or less expect. There's an awkward, almost theater kid kind of charm to him. Like, there's an intensity there, That's really interesting. But yeah, like listening to Kenny G, I learned more than I thought I was going to learn, and I enjoyed myself a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Alan Adams of the Main Edge talking movies here on Pass the Popcorn. What's up next?
Let's talk about Single All the Way.
Okay.
The frankly unfortunately named Netflix rom-com. You know, I've talked before about how Netflix has kind of cornered the rom-com market with their sort of algorithmically driven let's throw whatever at the wall and see what sticks kind of attitude. And yeah, that process results in a lot of, you know, forgettable movies. However, it also occasionally results in something that's really quite good. And that's what this movie is. It is a formulaic, perfectly fine holiday romantic comedy that just happens to be centered around a gay man. You know what I mean? And, you know, and there's no, like, you know, his sexuality is not a problem. Like, it's not some sort of closeted or coming out narrative. It's just, like, that character could have been a woman and you wouldn't have had to change the script at all. And frankly, I think that's progress. I think gay couples should have their own formulaic rom-coms just like the rest of us do. But yeah, it's a very sweet, funny movie. Manages to be heartwarming, never really gets saccharine. Or it gets a little cheesy sometimes, but that's part of the fun of it. So you've got this guy named Peter, played by Michael Urie. He's a social media manager, works for a company in Los Angeles, never really defined in the way that workplaces are often ill-defined in these kinds of movies. He's not particularly engaged with the work, but he's pretty good at it. He's got a boyfriend who's a cardiologist. They haven't been together for that long, but it's been long enough where he's like, okay, I'm finally going to bring a boyfriend home to meet my parents. But Peter's best friend, Nick, played by Philemon Chambers, who is just an exquisite rom-com character. He works for TaskRabbit, but he only does that to keep busy, because the royalties from his best-selling children's book keep rolling in. It's like, oh, okay, so you're a handyman and a children's book author. Fantastic. So Nick inadvertently discovers that the cardiologist's boyfriend is not all that he seems. They break up, and so Peter is once again wondering what he's going to do about going to what he's going to tell his family. So he comes up with a scheme. He's like, all right, Nick, we've been best friends for years. My parents, my family knows you, they love you. Let's just pretend we got together, and so I don't have to deal with all this crap when I'm home for the holiday this season. Nick very reluctantly agrees to go along for the ride. They've got this elaborate plan in place, and which immediately gets blown up as soon as they get back to Peter's hometown in New Hampshire, because his mom, Carol, played by the wonderful Kathy Najimy. She's wonderful. And she tells him, I set you up with a trainer at my gym, blind date. So he's got a blind date during the holidays. So they don't have to go through their whole, fake relationship thing. He winds up going on a blind date, and we're introduced to his family, his incredibly supportive and wonderful family. I mentioned the mom. His dad is played by Barry Bostwick. He's got two sisters, Lisa and Ashley, played by Jennifer Robertson, who's so good on Schitt's Creek. Oops. and Melanie Leishman. Respectively, a bunch of nieces and nephews and all that stuff. And they're all just sort of confused and have been for a very long time about why Peter and Nick aren't a thing already. But he's going off on these blind dates with this guy. He goes off on a blind date with this guy, James, who's perfectly lovely, played by Luke McFarlane. They hit it off, spending time together, which is well and good, but turns out that Peter's teenage nieces, Sophia and Daniela, they have other ideas. They've decided they're going to get Peter and Nick together. And then, plus Peter's, crazy, Aunt Sandy, played by the wonderful Jennifer Coolidge, is in town, and she has written and is directing the annual Christmas pageant. You know, it's a minor spoiler, but I'm going to say it just because it's going to make you laugh. The title of the pageant, Jesus H. Christ.
So, love it.
So that's the kind of movie we're talking about. Look, it checks a lot of the rom-com boxes, and it checks a lot of the holiday movie boxes in the same sorts of ways. And it kind of follows a formula, but does so in a way that keeps it a little bit fresh. And the performances are excellent, which really serves to elevate the proceedings in a lot of ways. It's interesting because you don't often wind up in a situation where your sort of two quote unquote leads are they're not necessarily the most important part of the movie because it's got such a wonderful supporting cast. Like mm-hmm. everyone's so talented and everyone gets plenty of time to do what they do, which really makes it very engaging. There are a lot of big laughs. Some wonderful outdoorsy holiday stuff. Although those of us who, with some familiarity of with New Hampshire, are going to recognize that they are nowhere in the New Hampshire that we know. filmed in Canada, there's definitely a very Canadian vibe to it all, which I'm not mad about. It's just very sweet. And like I said, you know, there's something to be said for this kind of representation where it doesn't have to be, you know, someone's, you know, how often is someone's heterosexuality like central to the plot of a movie? Like it doesn't happen. And it's nice to see, especially a company like Netflix, getting to the point where they can tell a story like this without, you know, turning it into some sort of like capital C commentary and just telling a nice story with good performances. Everyone's clearly having fun. And, yeah, so Single All the Way. I greatly enjoyed this movie. I was charmed by it, and I think anyone who loves holiday movies, who loves romantic comedies, or any combination therein is going to have a heck of a time.
Excellent. All right, finally, I'm looking forward to hearing what you think about the new film from Jane Campion.
Man, The Power of the Dog is so good, man. It is so good. And, you know, it's interesting because I've spent the last, 3 months longer hearing about how good this movie is. You know, it was in, it had a limited theatrical release a few weeks ago. It's been doing the festival circuit, you know, and so all these critics that I follow, whose opinions I greatly respect, are going on and on about how wonderful this movie is and how it's, you know, an awards contender and all that. And it's just like, okay, it can't possibly live up to this level of hype. Man, it is fantastic. Mm. I mean, Jane Campion's brilliant. Like yes. she's an incredible filmmaker. And you know, she directs, she wrote the screenplay adapted from the Thomas Savage novel of the same name. A novel which, by the way, came out back in 1967. Like I didn't realize the book was that old.
I didn't either.
And particularly when you watch the story and how sort of current it feels, even with the sort of the long ago setting, it's even more interesting to think about how prescient that novel is. We'll do the basic gist. So we're in Montana in 1925. You've got two brothers, the Burbank brothers. There's Phil, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, and George, played by Jesse Plemons. They're very wealthy for the time and place. They own this ranch that they have taken over from their aging parents. You know, George is this very genial, sort of quiet, kind of awkward guy. Basically, no, doesn't seem particularly comfortable in the sort of rough and tumble world in which he's sort of operating. Meanwhile, you've got Phil, is someone who is basically just born for the range. Although we find out later that he is someone who, contains multitudes, whether we're talking about, you know, he's a Phi Beta Kappa graduate from Yale, who majored in classics, but he's still like out riding the range, being a tough guy in the ways that, you know, cowboys are tough guys. So the two of them, along with their many hands, go on a cattle drive, and they wind up staying at and dining at this inn run by a woman named Rose Gordon, played by Kirsten Dunst. She's a widow. She's got a teenage son named Peter, played by Cody Smith McPhee. And the visit's kind of tense. Like Phil goes out of his way to be a jerk to pretty much everyone, but particularly the widow Gordon and her son. But George is taken with Rose and decides he kind of returns and visits a few times, and before you know it, they're wed. They've gotten married, and you know he brings her back to the ranch, and that leads to some. We'll just say suspicion on Phil's part. He views her as an interloper, as perhaps a gold digger, or someone who's seeking to take advantage of his brother. But a lot of that is springing from a much deeper and, frankly, darker place that I'm not going to go into too much detail about because I don't want to spoil anything. And it only gets more complicated when the son comes to live on the ranch as well. You know, there's an antagonistic relationship between Phil and the boy, which slowly starts to develop as Phil finds some a bit of a kindred spirit in Peter, and the you know they sort of start opening up to one another a little bit, and we start to see that you know Phil is a far more complicated guy than we're initially led to believe. Someone with feelings and attitudes that aren't necessarily acceptable in this time and place. And so rather than deal with those, whatever they may be, he just chooses to bottle them up. And that leads in a lot of ways to his sort of darker behaviors. And we just watch as this sort of, you know, stitched together family unit just sort of like ebbs and flows and you know, struggles to cohere, leading to, frankly, some pretty tragic happenings as things go along.
Excellent. I can't wait to see.
It's beautiful. Like it's like she does a wonderful job of capturing sort of the wide open spaces in such a way that really captures the beauty, but also the sort of bleakness of it all. Like visually, like I'm reminded of like some of the shots in something like Nomadland. Like they're very different movies, but it's that same sort of embrace of the American West and that sort of isolated aesthetic that you can generate from that. And the performance, good Lord, the performances, man. Benedict Cumberbatch is great and I've seen him be great. I've never seen him this great. Like, honestly, yeah. Like it is the best performance I've ever seen out of him. It is layered. It is compelling. He is just this wonderful portrait of this, I don't know, like malevolent masculinity. You know, there's this wonderful toxicity to his every interaction with the world around him that just, it makes your skin crawl in a way that you're just, but he's so inherently charismatic that you're also sort of drawn to that. And for an actor to be able to generate that kind of internal struggle in you while you're watching him is just stunning. And again, Jesse Plemons is a phenomenal performer. Like, somehow still underrated, which I find fascinating because, I mean, I think he's as talented a guy as there is out there. And I feel like you never really hear his name come up in the same way that some of his peers do. Kirsten Dunst. I hadn't seen Kirsten Dunst in anything in a while.
No. And somebody, I read somewhere, someone mentioned a scene where she teaches him to dance.
Yes.
And said it's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's just like there, and the whole film is just made up of those small moments where it's just like, again, it's illustrative of the sort of mastery of craft that Jane Campion has, because she can really build those small moments into something so significant while also embracing the larger picture, both literally and figuratively, and finding these wonderful like wide shots of like open range or the hills or wide shots of like a cattle drive, like, you know, things that are sort of standard issue when it comes to your idea of Westerns, but sort of, I don't know, brought to life in a way that's different than what you've seen before. It just, yeah, I can't stress enough, how much I loved this movie. In fact, this week's cover story is going to be my best movies of the year. And this one's on it. You know,
nice.
Like it's just, I mean, just phenomenal.
Alan Adams talking movies with us here. Pass the popcorn on downtown. Thank you, Al.
My pleasure.
We'll see you back here Wednesday.
Yeah, you will.